Yes, so Shamit asked me to talk about something related to the string U1s and some phonological properties. Part of this, what I'll talk about, it's relatively old stuff. Part of it, it's more recent, and it's based on various collaborations over the last year, who's been at Tripo, Korsky, Savoy, and some younger people, Mambrini and Zampati. So, and actually I realized that over the last 2 weeks there are a lot of new results on the full-fledged string theory about some of the things which I'll describe mostly at the field theory level. So let me start with some relatively old stuff about the possible connection between non-perturbative dynamics, string E1, and supersymmetry breaking. So, let me remind you that we are talking, the framework will be a supersymmetric QCD, eventually embedded in a string construction with a certain number of colors, a certain number of flavors, which will be, for a time being, less than the number of colors. The theory is asymptotically free. It has a dynamical scale in the infrared, where the gauge couplings become large, a certain scale, which is related to the fundamental scale, let's say the Planck mass, by a relation like that. It's actually scale invariant, but I write it in this way, where B0 is the beta function of the this sector, which I'll interpret it like a hidden sector. And as you know, in a certain global limit, there is a non-perturbative sweep potential derived by Affleck, Dine, Seiberg. Let me denote the quarks by Q. They have a color and flavor indices, anti-quark, so it's a vector-like theory. So that's the non-perturbative sweep potential, which is governed by the symmetries of the by the global symmetry of the theory. Once the this mesons confined, these are gauge invariant objects, so confined. And if you just have this kind of theory, it has a runaway vacuum going to infinite mesons. So in order to stabilize it, we are typically adding some mass terms, which you have to find again in the string theory where they come from. So that's the sphere potential of this symmetric QCD, an effective description. So these are the mesons, and this is determinant in the flavor space. And the mass has some indices, it's a matrix. Now, if you are discussing a string theory, very often you have some, so what I call here stringy U1s, generically denoted by that. I just mean this kind of symmetries which have anomalies at first sight, anomalies of this type, would be inconsistent from a field theory point of view, but as you know, there is a four-dimensional version of the Green-Schwarz mechanism, which makes these kind of anomalies cancel. So you have this kind of triangle anomalies, U1x cubed, the mixed gravitational anomaly, and the mix with, for our particular example, with this hidden sector actually, all these anomalies are different from zero. And the anomalies will be cancelled indeed. Now, a typical example, which I'll discuss a little bit because it's very clear cut actually, and that's the best example to describe what has to do with non-perturbative dynamics with supersymmetry breaking. I mean, the main message, I think, would be that when you put the two things together, which are relatively generics, generic string theory, non-perturbative dynamics, and the stringy ones, not only you get some non-perturbative dynamics, which is interesting, but actually generically you do break supersymmetry.
I guess I'm
just trying to find that.
Well, I think for a number of favors, equal number of colors, the same will happen. I'll not describe it, but again, you'll break supersymmetry. For bigger, we didn't really study it. I think also break supersymmetry, we didn't really study
that. Because it would still be asymptotic.
Yes,
so.
Yes. So again, the typical example is the heterotic string in which there is the number of these U1s. It's 1 or 0, so it can be, we can have one, in perturbative examples, I mean, we can have one U1 or none of them, which is anomalous in perturbative settings. And what happens was described actually in a paper by Diane Seberg and Witten, basically, that the universal axion, which is the partner of the dilaton actually, gets a mixing with the gauge field. You have a mixing which you can see it from this Lagrangian if you expand, a Stueckelberg mixing between the axion, the imaginary part of the this field and the gauge field, which render the gauge field massive actually. You can have typically other moduli fields which for the time being are not important for us. You can have matter. So what happens is that because of this mixing, the gauge field becomes massive. You can also see here a mass for the gauge field, the quadratic term. If you expand and if a quadratic term on the superfields, we have a mass. So this U1 is broken typically very high energies, at energy of the order of this parameter, which is basically one Luck factor, so it's very high. So the question is, why do we care about? So the picture we have for the time being, we have a dynamical scale here. You have, let's say, fundamental scale, string scale, and let me call the mass where this U1 is broken for a time being by psi. You have a picture where this lambda is much smaller than psi, which is slightly smaller than the fundamental scale, typically. So the question is, why do you care about keeping this U1 in describing the perturbative dynamics here? This is the energy. Well, we wouldn't care too much, actually, if supersymmetry would be unbroken. So if the dynamics would be such that supersymmetry is unbroken, I think we wouldn't care too much. But however, as you'll see, supersymmetry is broken. And let me just... So the claim is that non-perturbative SUSY dynamics plus string E1 that does break supersymmetry, actually, generically. And the claim is actually the following. Not only this is, so I'll try to explain a little bit why. That's the first reason. And secondly, that the mediation actually will look very close to gravitational mediation, but slightly stronger, in the sense that you will get, in the end, some soft terms in the observable sector, which will be slightly, which will be related to this general condensation scale divided by this scale of breaking, which will be bigger than at something which we would call gravitational mediation. Gravitational mediation, I mean, if you believe that you break supersymmetry by general condensation, you expect a soft term of the order of the general condensation scale divided by the Planck mass. So that's bigger. So not only you break supersymmetry, but you break it, as you see, slightly stronger than gravity. So that's a very efficient way of breaking supersymmetry.
Is this a universal mass, or does it depend on U1 charges?
This mass depends, it's basically this famous sum of the all charge in the spectrum of the heterotic string divided by one Luck factor. This was computed, I think, by Sen and Attic Dixon. Yeah, Attic Dixon, Sen, and other people, yes. This one? Well, not really, because, well, in some sense, well, as you'll see what happens the following. So this mass, let's say for the soft masses, I'll explain a little bit. Basically, the soft masses in the observable sector are given by some charges, something called act charges of various fields, times d term, and I'll show that this is different from zero, and eventually something else. Now, the point here is the following. So if you have this hidden sector, if you have this observable sector, and you have this U1, as you know in the heterotic case, if you have some mixed anomalies with this hidden sector, and this mixed anomalies is precisely the case I'm interested in here, actually, as you'll see in a moment.
And this U1 be an R symmetry?
This U1 will be an R symmetry after a certain modulus, which is hidden here for the time being, will be fixed. Here, this lambda, for me, it's fixed. But it will be actually, in the end of the day, and actually I should write it immediately, right away, this will become actually related to some coefficient to the gauge coupling to the depth of the dilator, actually. So before this modulus is fixed, before it's stabilized, it's a gauge symmetry. After it's stabilized, it becomes gauge asymmetry. So what I want to say is that you'll see in a moment, but you can already see from here, that for all these things to make sense, you need the mixed anomalies between this and this. However, in the heterotic case, there is a universal Green-Schwarz constellation, which tells you that there are mixed anomalies between this and this, and therefore observable sector is charged. This anomalous U1 is forced to mediate between the hidden and observable sector. It's forced to do it. And therefore, you have these charges, actually. So it's a kind of a gauge mediation, but the charges of this with respect to this U1. So it's not gauge mediation of our gauge. Okay, I'll say something at the end, but I can say it right away. I mean, if these charges are universal, give some universal masses, which if this contribution are high enough, then you solve the flavor problem. If you want to combine this with something else, like these flavor symmetries, then these are flavor dependent, then you have to worry about them. And, okay, there are various options, yeah. Okay, so let me go on. So the gauge kinetic function, as you know, in the heterotic string are basically given by the dilaton times some numbers, it's Casmundi levels, which don't matter so much for the time being. And basically, the main reason I wrote this, as was explained by this paper of Michael and the Cyber and Witten, is that the dilaton has the axion, actually, has nonlinear gauge transformations. So let me write a superfield. Alpha is a superfield. The imaginary part is the real gauge parameter. The S gets shifted. So that's a superfield relation. For the gauge parameter, the imaginary part will get shifted. So S is not gauge invariant. You can see it from this mixing here. And then the problem, which was actually, I think, for the first time raised in a paper, I think, by Banks and Dine, was what's happening with Gaugino condensation in the case we have these stringy symmetries, I think. Well, this cannot happen, of course. So this kind of spare potential cannot exist. That's clear. Because it's not gauge invariant. But what happens in this case is the following. So if you have this kind of shift of the under gauge transformations, as you know, there is a universal way in heterotic case to cancel perturbative with the anomalies. You take the triangle anomalies. Triangle anomalies mean actually you take any kind of gauge group factor here. Here's this U1. These are the kind of anomalies you find in heterotic models. This means even U1 itself and any kind of other gauge factors. You find something. Let me call them by some name, C. You add the variation of Lagrangian coming from this term, so you have this kind of gauge couplings. So they are not gauge invariant either, because it's, it gets shifted. And this has to be equal to zero, because otherwise the theory would be inconsistent and the string theory is consistent. So by doing this, you find this universal relation, which is for any kind of gauge group factor, the ratio of the anomalies divided by this Kasmodi level has to be universal. It's equal to this number. In particular, for the cubic anomaly itself, this would be important for us. And it's given basically by the sum of the charges of all fields in the spectrum. Now, what would be important for us here is this, this anomaly, actually, which is the anomaly between the ZC1 and the hidden sector. So if you have an anomalous U1 in the heterotic string perturbatively, obviously you need a mixed anomaly with any kind of gauge group, in particular with the hidden sector gauge group. Let me denote with X the charges. I'll not be very careful with the numbers, so I not put all the factors here. But you see that this mixed anomaly is proportional to the sum of the charges here, which means that in particular, the mesons, which I introduced there, have a charge under the U1, actually. They have a charge which is different from zero. So this theory, which is vector-like, originally becomes chiral because of this anomalous U1, actually. And now there is a simple exercise we can check. It's not there is no arbitrariness here at all, actually. Either it works, either it doesn't work. So you can check now what is the charge of this dynamical scale, because this dynamical scale now has a charge. The dynamical scale has a charge here. I'm coming, yes, it will be field dependent, indeed. Which from a string theory point of view, it's welcome, because there are no really mass terms, so that's welcome. So this dynamical scale, which is, if you want, again, I'm not really very careful, but it's something like that. It gets a transformation, actually, under this U1, which is just this. And you can, the meson by itself transform has this charge, so the determinant of the mesons, if you want, get a transformation. Again, I'm not very careful. There is an NF because there is a determinant of the meson here. And actually, if you do very careful the analysis, I mean, you just put the factors of pi, you realize that the charge of this is exactly the charge of this. And there is no arbitrariness here. I mean, in the heterotic case, that's completely universal, so nothing you can do. So in any kind of heterotic model in which you have anomalous U1, you know that the Gaugian condensation is compatible with the U1 symmetry. Now, as Shamit already asked, this theory becomes chiral, and therefore this is not allowed. Now, what happens? Well, now these things are not completely generic anymore. So for the time being, everything is completely generic. So this is gauge invariant. I mean, I made no assumption at all. Now, what happens in the following? What happens in the following is that let me assume, just to make an assumption, actually, that this sum is positive. That doesn't matter if it's positive or negative. What means positive here means that this Philopoulos term actually has the same sign as the charge of the meson fields actually here. If you look at these anomaly conditions, which I wrote somewhere, which I didn't, what is this, his one? So there is a relation which is a mixed anomaly between the U1 and the hidden sector, which is proportional to this factor here, which is basically the Philopoulos term. This parameter here is basically the Philopoulos term induced in the gauge theory, because the Philopoulos term, you can read it from here, is proportional to this mixing. You can read it from here, is the linear term in the V. So let me take this convention, and therefore it means that for this convention, the mesons, or the quarks if you want, the mesons have a sum of the charge which is also positive. So what happens is the following. You know that in all the perturbative heterotopy models, you never break supersymmetry with like that. So if you just generate a Philip Plus term, if you just generate this Philip Plus term, which actually this Philip Plus term, you can even write it in a more elegant way, something like derivative of the Keeler respect to the S field, if you want. You can see it from this Keeler. You would say at first sight that, okay, you have a gauge coupling of the U1, you have the Philip Plus term, you have some matter fields with some charges. There are in particular these mesons, and actually you will keep the in the infrared the degree field of the mesons. Their Keeler is not very well known, but it is more or less, its explicit form doesn't quite matter if you want, but there is something which is, it acts like a field with a positive charge, certainly, because it's a field with a positive charge. So if you want, you can write even a canonical Keeler if you want. So what happens is that these mesons, of course, cannot compensate this Philip Plus term because they have the same sign of the charge. So at first sight, you said you break supersymmetry here because it's determinative from zero. This is never the case. There is not a single example, as far as I know, heterotopy models, which breaks perturbative supersymmetry, which means that there is at least one field, at least one, eventually several, but at least one, which has appropriate charge. Let me call it minus one here, in order to compensate this Philip Plus term. That's the string data, and it's realized in all cases. So what happens perturbative is that this field will cancel the Philip Plus term, supersymmetry is unbroken, if you don't have non-perturbative dynamics. As you see here, it's precisely this kind of field. This charge is, the sum of charge is positive. This charge has, this field is negative charge. It's precisely the kind of charge which allows you to write a non-normalizable operator, which can be Yukawa coupling, can be a higher order, higher dimensional operator with some coefficient in front.
This is the field in the perturbative spectrum?
Yes. That's always the case. You always have a field which cancels the Philip Plus term. There can be several, of course, but let me assume it's in just one.
Why can't there be a closed frame module dependence on?
You could have some non-perturbative, you mean some exponential?
I mean, the
Nash term
depend on the
closed frame. It can depend on some, it can depend. Yes, it can. No, but you see, the only closed string moduli which is really charged under the one is the S itself. Yeah. The other are uncharged. So you can have a dependence here, let's say, on Keeler moduli. It doesn't change so much what I'm saying. If you bit something depending on S, it would be non-perturbative in itself. And I'm talking about perturbative kind of object here.
Correction start
with
this question. Those are these modular functions that
come. Okay, they can be. Well, maybe not here, but not here. Not in super potential, but okay.
You change the
story
of the full modular
function. Sure, I'll discuss about moduli later on. For the timing, I just want to tell you that this model breaks supersymmetry even in the global limit, actually. It will break in the global limit. And that's why we cannot really, even if this scale is much higher than this scale, this way we cannot really integrate out this gauge field here. So so basically, the effective Lagrangian for all this is something which looks like, let me put for 1 second the modulus here. But I'll not discuss here the modulus. I'll discuss it a bit later on. So you have this. This is the kind of typical Lagrangian you find. Mesons here. And the Keeler. So first of all, there is this mixing between the S and this anomalous U1. You have typically the other modulus, the matter, and so on. That's the typical kind of Lagrangian you get here. And that's a non-perturbative piece, which is gauge invariant. Now, So let me take the global limit again. I'll discuss later on what happens really concerning the stabilization, but let me just, for the time being, ignore the stabilization. Just to anticipate, this model also stabilizes the modulus, actually. It does stabilize the modulus once you add later on, let's say, a constant coming from flux. I'll come later on to this. But let me just, for the time being, tell you the simplest part of the story, that this breaks per symmetry in the global limit. So I'm just fixing the modulus for the time being. So the fact that this breaks per symmetry, and now again I'm going to in the global limit, you can see it really from this, if you write the, so now I'm really taking the global limit. You see what happens. This field, phi, tends to compensate for the closed term, and that's what it's always doing, actually, perturbatively. The problem, once it does it, is the auxiliary field of the field phi is proportional to the meson itself. The measure itself. So you cannot put both d equal to 0 and f equal to 0. There is no way you can do both of these. So this model breaks per symmetry in the global limit, actually. And of course, if once you put it in a full supergravity, this will not change. You can do actually a full comp. Okay.
In the full supergravity, there are also a supersymmetric vacuum, but far away.
There will be the runaway. There will be the runaway in the direction of the modulus. That's clear, yeah. Now, what's interesting here, but I don't talk about it at all, it's actually you can do an analytic computation of the soft break in terms here by expanding in a certain ratio. I mean, this lambda over psi is much more than 1. And actually, it's a very nice, you can do a very nice computation analytically, actually. We did an analytic computation. And what you get is the following. Okay, before going on, let me tell you that if you would not be for this supersymmetry breaking, the story would end more or less in the following way. If you wouldn't break supersymmetry, this field phi would get a VEV, very large VEV. Then the gauge function of the gauge kinetic function of this hidden sector, which was started with this S actually, if you would integrate out the flavors actually, will give some threshold corrections if you want, which can be computed very simply by matching the dynamical scale of the high energy theory with and without flavors. You get something like that. Now this becomes gauge invariant. You can check that now this is gauge invariant. So in the low energy theory, everything is gauge invariant, so you have nothing pathological and strange. Everything will be perfect. Because of the fact that you break supersymmetry, the only thing which changes is the fact that you get some soft terms. It's like gravity. You, if you want to can decouple gravity, but you get soft terms. It's exactly the same story. You actually can do a computation, analytic computation, in this limit where these two scales are far away. And you get actually the something like the following. So again, the matter fields have to be charged. You have no choice. That's, I think, the nice part of all this. You have a few choices here. Everything is more or less fixed. And what you get actually here, it's something which is proportional to the mixed anomaly. So basically, in some sense, it's kind of anomaly contributions here, but this kind of mixed anomalies between the D1 and the various gauge groups. Yes?
If phi also gets an F term, I don't know what the balance is, but if phi gets an F term when you go to the vacuum,
yes.
Why aren't there non-uniform contributions?
There are. There are. If you want, I can come back to it at the end.
Is it parametrically smaller? Is it smaller?
Not necessarily, actually. No. Actually, as far as I know, what we did really is they're the same order.
Is phi,
of the order of this, very large, very large.
Okay, so even though lambda is small.
Yes. Well, so again, the mesons will basically adjust to give the supersymmetric dynamics, whereas the field phi is basically taking care of this Sphylioplos term at the first order. And then there are some mixing up between the fact when they couple the two systems, basically. So what you get, so let me define first of all a Gugino condensation scale. Gugino condensation scale here is basically this object appearing as superpotential. When you write this non-perturbative superpotential, this is exactly the Gugino condensation scale obtained by integrating out all flavors. So you get actually this, where this is this, okay. You get actually soft terms of this order. So this we can compute actually. So as I anticipated at the beginning, they are slightly bigger than the supergravity contributions actually. That's the good part. And actually the gravitino mass here is the same order, roughly speaking. So gravitino mass, that's true, but the mass itself is of this order. So the soft term itself is of this order, actually.
These are Gugino's in the hidden set.
Yes. Well, in this case, in the heterotic case, the Gugino masses are relatively suppressed here. You have to make some... they couple to S, depends how S is stabilized, if it gets auxiliary field or not. They get also contribution from this field phi, actually, but it's relatively small. I think it's small. This will change if we do it in the context, let's say, of oriented folds, which we'll discuss later on. In principle, it appeared also in the same way, in principle, except that my argument is not really correct because I integrated out the supersymmetric way to get this. So this is not quite correct, actually. But it's roughly speaking, qualitatively the same. So, you get actually these soft terms, the order of gravitino mass, and what will be important later on actually for when we discuss some uplifting things, in this case you get some F terms. As Rami asks, there are some F terms actually here. Something like the gravitino mass. And the D term actually will be of the order gravitino mass squared, actually. So much, much smaller. It's much smaller, but if you have fields which are charged under it, it gets basically the same kind of contributions. Because the soft terms get this squared, whereas they are linear in this D term, actually. Okay, so that's the story for the heterotic case. So the conclusion is this breaks supersymmetry, actually. And if you would like to discuss the stabilization of the modulus S here, you would also stabilize it, but then you'd have to, in order to stabilize, you would need to invoke this constant superpotential, which in the heterotic case is supposed to be not as small as it should be, and maybe it's better to discuss it in the oriented fold case. But you will also stabilize the modulus if you put everything together and do a minimization with respect to the modulus. So, let me come to the... what changes in the oriented fold case? In the oriented fold case, so do you have questions with this? No. Okay. So for the oriented fold case now, the difference is that this mechanism is no more complete universal. You have to specify a bit more the context, actually. Because for the oriented folds, you can have several stringy ones. Stringy means if you want anomalous, which means that they will mix up with Rameau-Rameau axions. And I'll discuss an example with based on internal magnetic fields or intersecting brains, if you want. Gugino condensation can happen on various kind of brains, and will not be very important, but I'll assume actually when I write some formulas, I'll discuss Gugino condensation on these seven brains in orienting fold, where you have this parity in all space line coordinates, actually. I'll discuss example with internal magnetic fields, which are T-dual to intersecting brains. In which actually the partners of the Keller moduli actually are really involved in this mechanism. I will give you an example, a qualitative example, in 10 minutes, but let me just more or less tell you what changes in this kind of effect Lagrangian. And of course, I'll restrict for the time being to the simplest kind of Lagrangian containing, let's say, one such field. And then I'll try to give you an example and show you that the same phenomenon holds. This is gauge invariant, and I'll try to give it in a more or less explicit string example based on intersecting brains, to see that this non-perturbable dynamics is indeed gauge invariant. But the kind of effective Lagrangian you can get here is the following. So let me put everything in a context which is more appropriate for discussing moduli stabilization, if people are doing. So suppose you have some flux that you stabilize, let's say, dilaton complex structure moduli. This will leave a constant aspect potential, which eventually could be small. Then if you are doing a general condensation on these seven brains, you will get actually the gauge kinetic function, which will be mostly given by this scalar modulus, actually. These kind of operators, which are meson masses, are supposed to arise again perturbative, and I'll give you an example which is indeed arise perturbative. They can have matter, and the Keller. So in this case, as I said, it's mostly the Keller moduli which mix with these Amoramo axions. There can be several axions, several U1s, and just write for the time being a kind of qualitative Lagrangian. The gauge function on these seven brains is mostly T, but you can also have contribution depending on the dilaton if you have flux on this four cycle which the D7 brain wraps. D3 is basically S. This is kind of the Lagrangian which you get in these kind of models. And the question is the following. I'll try to... The question is the following here. Again, if this is gauge invariant, and secondly, if you have a kind of brain realization of this, we can show more or less that gauge invariance is okay, and if you can argue that indeed or not, you break supersymmetry. And I make some comments.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
If you have more than one phi field that has the opposite charge, so that could be in general some line of field and one phi field and stuff in the mass term.
Yes.
Does the supersymmetry go away?
It depends. It can. The supersymmetry can go away, indeed. It depends on the details.
So you think it's generic? You just have one
such phi field? No, this is not generic. But even if you have several, you can still break supersymmetry. It depends on the details. But it will not be completely generic, yes. So... before going to a more or less explicit model, let me make some comments about some recent papers concerning uplifting of this KKLT vacua with D terms. There are a lot of papers. I'm not bothering giving you the kind of arguments showing that, if it's gauge invariant or not, where it is, so what is gauge invariant. So this will not be gauge invariant by itself, this will be gauge invariant. So in principle the uplifting can go on and it will go on, but let me just give you some scales which you will get if you do an explicit analysis actually, and then I'll come to an explicit model. So these are just qualitative arguments. It's about uplifting. I suppose that most of you heard about this uplifting originally by anti-brains in KKL scenario, or by D-terms proposed by Borges, Carlos Quevedo. I'll just tell you something about the what you need in order to uplift, and you'll see later on what you can really get actually. So the gauge invariant is not an issue once you do it properly like that. This is gauge invariant, and you get a D-term, that's not a big problem, even if it's not the original proposal. Now, the problem is the following, actually. You have basically two cases, two situations, actually. The first case is more or less the one which I discussed in the heterotopy case, which goes over to the Lorentzian case. In other words, a case in which you have this field phi. This field phi will basically take care of the phi Laplace term. But what you get, generically, you get some F terms when you do the analysis of this order, and D terms of order of the order of gravity 1 square. And this is, the reason is that, again, if you assume that the Gugino condensation scale is much, much smaller than this phi Laplace term, this field will cancel the phi Laplace term very efficiently, actually. And only by putting the second scale in the problem, the supersymmetry will be broken. That will be this term will be very small. That's what will happen when we do the analysis. And therefore, when you write the potential, which has some F terms, have some D terms, what you'll get is the following. You'll get something from the F terms, which actually, if you do the analysis, look like something which is negative, actually. You'll find, even if in this case you have several F terms, there is the F term of the T, there is the F term of this field phi, actually. Also, this field will have a F term. You'll get a negative contribution, and you'll get a positive contribution from this D terms, actually. So these are F contributions, and these are the D term contributions. And basically, if you want really to start from a very deep anti-de Sitter and bring it to zero energy, what you'll need the degravitational mass to be of the order of this mass parameter squared. And that's the...
So you're saying you need a very small phi Laplace?
You either need a very small phi Laplace term, which is, of course, impossible in heterotopy case, or a very large gravitational mass, which is the most likely situation. I'm sorry? Well, in the type 2b case, in principle, it's possible to have a psi very small. That's, I think, it's... Yes, you can have... the phi Laplace term has several contributions. This is some of these angles intersecting brain language, for example, which can be very, very close to zero. So this could happen. But it remains to be seen once you stabilize all these moduli which appear in the F terms in the phi Laplace term if it really happens, actually. It depends on the details, actually. Well, what you would need is to redshift this contribution, probably. Oh, no, not this one, no.
Another way of saying it is it's a strongly coupled field theory, coupled gravity.
Well, in this case, it doesn't help at all. I mean, in this case, I don't think it helps at all. In this case, basically, this uplift contribution is extremely small. I talked about a second case in which warping could play a role. The second case... for the heterotic case, it was just this case. There's no other case in the heterotic case. For the second case, actually, which could happen in principle in the Orient defaults, is that the fields which are forced to cancel the Fourier process time, this is meant to be seen. I'll show some example in which this seems to be the case. But the fields which are forced to cancel the Fourier process time because of the charges are the condensate itself, the mesons itself. You'll probably not see it in an explicit example because I think I'm running out of time and I'm not going to the details, but you can construct explicit examples, more or less explicit, in which you can see that this can happen in principle. In this case, the situation is completely different. In this case, and if you have, so this is not generic. In this case, if you have a coupling, which is a perturbative Yukawa coupling, actually, it's perturbative because this was this quark antiquark, so this is just Yukawa coupling. Then, if you just look at this potential, and again, just take the D-term contribution, let's say. In this case, the sign of this object is opposite. You can see that you'll have a very large decontribution. Because why? Because now this field will tend to compensate the Fourier process term, but the auxiliary field of this field phi is proportional to this field itself. So now you cannot have a very small, very efficient cancellation here. So in this case, actually, what you will get, now you'll get a very large decontribution. And to anticipate, you not really see it. To anticipate, I think this is possible. However, it more or less implies starting with intersecting brain models, which in some sense supersymmetry is broken from the start. You start from some, let's say, magnetized nine brains, and you put some fluxes which induce anti-brain-like charges, lower dimensional anti-brain-like charges. So you can generate this, but I don't know if you can do it in a way which looks like really spontaneous. Whereas this one, you can do it in a way which really looks like a spontaneous breaking. So in this case, you get an F and D-term which are very, very large, actually. They are very, very large. However, because you have this condition of the vacuum energy, you will get in this case that the gravitino mass has values which for relatively natural values of this Fourier process term is very high also. Maybe not as high as like that, but still it's relatively high, actually. For example, if you have what you need here to get a TV gravitino mass, you need something which is intermediate values for the Fourier process term. So as was already said, in intersecting brain models, indeed you can have Fourier process term which is much smaller than one. Coming back to this case actually here, it is possible to get, and also to this case, in both cases to realize the uplifting with a relatively low gravitino mass, you need Fourier process term which is much more than one.
Is that only true for large volume?
No, you can have angles which are relatively big, but if they add up to zero, the Fourier process term are zero. Okay.
But then your approximation lambda was more than C of psi.
That's an issue. You have to take a dynamical scale which is even lower.
Yeah.
Yes.
Your lambda term itself is very small. Then.
Okay. And then you have to do another. Yes. And then you have to worry about in which sense is dynamics supersymmetric, actually. Correct. So. Well, what I wanted to say here in this qualitative picture is that in principle you can use this to do the uplifting. However, generically you either need very, very small Fourier plus term, extremely small, you have to see a posteriori if it's possible dynamically, or you can certainly do it with very large gravitino masses. That's certainly possible.
Since the F terms here are all enough, that means there's large to be from, probably just make them forget about the B
Actually, my conclusion, well, the simplest way, I think, to do really the uplift is to use a dynamical supersymmetry breaking sector, a dynamic intermediate scale, and do the uplifting. I think it's, from this point of view, it's simpler. Okay, let me just give you a kind of picture. I mean, I can give a model, but I'm afraid I don't have time to give you a model. I'm just give you what kind of... What kind of model I have in mind, which in some sense relies explicitly this situation, actually. I can give you more details, but the models are not completely satisfactory, actually. So they have, it's still an open issue if you really can do it completely and break supersymmetry, I think. But the models, which are actually relatively simple to construct, are the following. Start with type 1 and add D-brains, D9 brains actually, magnetized, which are T-dual 2s intersecting brains. And again, I can write these wrapping numbers, but I don't do it because the time is short. Basically, this is not, maybe not, it's certainly not the unique way to do it. It's maybe not even the simplest way to do it, but what you can do is to write a model which looks like the following. You have here a unitary gauge group, which contains an unabelian gauge factor. So you have here a stack of brains. Here you have a U1, and actually, if you want, like, just one thing I write and not give any details anymore, let me call this stack M1, M2, M3, just for those of you which like these things. So the wrapping numbers, if you want, this is the flux actually, which corresponds to the so this is I just make some comments and tell you what you get actually. So these are, you put fluxes in, these are the first internal torus, second internal torus, third internal torus. These are the three sets of magnetized brains. So what you need to do actually, and you have to do it in Norby-fold. You have to do it in Norby-fold because otherwise you don't satisfy the global tapping condition. That's the global model, it's a completely consistent model. This flux you add here preserves supersymmetry if the volume of the second and the third tori are the same, which will reflect in the end in the fact that the moduli, if these moduli are equal to each other, this flux preserves supersymmetry. This flux preserves supersymmetry if these two moduli are equal. And this one preserves supersymmetry in this case. Okay. You can check in this case that the chiral spectrum of the model, the only chiral states in the spectrum are the following. Something which I'll call quarks here, which have charge minus 1 respect to this U1 and is the fundamental of this unitary gauge group here. And there are two of them. There is a multiplicity of two coming from this wrapping number, which you can even compute it immediately. There are two states which are in the anti-fundamental of this UN and have a charge plus 1 respect to this U1. And there is a field which I'll call phi, actually. That's the field I'll call phi here, which has charges minus 1 respect to this gauge group and plus 1 with respect to this one here. And there are two of them, actually, because, again, if I'm giving you all these wrapping numbers, you can compute the spectrum. And they are the only chiral states in the spectrum. Okay, if you want, but I not really discuss. It's a Z2 times Z2 orbifold with no discrete torsion. I can give you the details. No, it's not. It's just an example to It's just an example to show you where this kind of a sector can arise. There is no standard model here. So this satisfies all global constraints, actually. You can check the total conditions. Even if there are no five brains, they are satisfied because you induce charges which completely cancel the tension and the charges, the orientable planes. I'll not get into this. What I want to tell you is the following, actually, now. You can do in this example you know the master spectrum. You can compute actually the anomalies in this case. The anomalies in this case actually, it's a matrix of anomalies, no? You have several kind of anomalies here. You can write it in a matrix form if you want, because you have only fields charged in the bifundamental, which are chiral. You have a 3x3 matrix here, which are not right. You can also compute how the axions, which are partners of these fields here, so there are three axions here, which will participate into the anomaly cancellation, which you can check, the partners of this volume-like moduli. You can compute how do they couple to these U1s, actually, and you get something like this. You can compute just because once you put fluxes on the D9 brains, you know that the D9 brains have a gauge coupling, which is S. Once you start to put fluxes, you induce additional couplings to these fields. And you can compute the variation of these axions, if you want, under the gauge transformations, such that these anomalies here are cancelled by the gauge variations here. And you can do better than that, actually. You can do better than that because you know you can compute the mixing of the axions with the various gauge fields. You can with the various gauge fields from the Bezzomino term. From this mixture between these axions and the gauge fields, you can construct the Keller potential of these moduli fields, actually, exactly as we did before, actually. And I'm not writing it here, but you have some... let me write it like that. Now, instead of having just one kind of anomaly coefficient, you have a matrix 3x3. You can compute it explicitly, actually. From this, you can go... First of all, you can check that the gauge transformation coming from here is precisely the gauge transformation which you get by canceling these field theoretical anomalies here. This you can check. And from here, you can write Phi-Lupulos terms, actually. From this, you can write Phi-Lupulos terms. And for this particular case, just to get you a feeling what you get, from this particular case, you get Phi-Lupulos terms, which are of the type... like that. Proportional to a certain number here, or if you want equal to a certain number, let me call it alpha, this number, which is some pi factors, you get this. And actually, this it's in agreement with what's written here from the beginning. If this volume are equal here, it's equal to, and therefore the Phi-Lupulos term is zero, and so on. So all this you can do it by string computation, you can do it by field theoretic anomalies. My point, I think, is that you can do it completely by field theoretic anomalies. There is no ambiguity neither in this game. And now, you can check the following. You can check that so this is a model which is relatively more complicated because it has three ones actually, has one on a Abelian gauge group, but now you have all the charges. You know how these various axions transform on the gauge symmetries, and you can check again. You can check that the mesons have the right transformation properties such that this, again, this to be gauge invariant. I'm sorry? Okay. Well, I went a bit too far. If I'm giving you a model who satisfy really the global... Okay. I think I forgot one step. If I'm giving you a complete global model, actually, the complete global model satisfy all conditions is the following, which is not exactly this. A complete global model satisfies all the constraints is a model which has actually U2 here. And you get the you take some wrapping numbers which has instead of which are like that actually. This is a complete global model. No. Here, no. Okay, sorry. Yeah. So in this model, actually, which is really complete, I'm sorry. I think I said at some point that this is a complete global model, and actually, what I had in mind was that a model which was, this model here is not actually global. This one here, the one which is really global, to give an example, is something which has the same kind of fields here, but actually they come in the multiplicity 16 actually. So this by far has a number of flavor which is bigger number of colors. So this I can give a explicit model, and this is not even asymptotically free. This is not a global model, I'm sorry. But what I wanted to say is that if you take the model which is there and you reduce the gauge group to U1 by taking less brains and you give some mass, or you take the and then you take these wrapping numbers here, this is not a global model anymore. Actually, you get this, which is much simpler. But this is not a global model, I'm sorry. I said at some point that it's a global. What I had in mind is that all the anomaly analysis can be done completely in a global model. And what you find is something which is completely consistent, which I wrote here. Now, you can do this anomaly analysis also in this model, which is just local. I'm sorry. This one is local. The other one is global. It's exactly the same orbifold. If you do it here, you do the same analysis of anomalies. You find exactly this. However, this is not a global model. Now you have to add other brains. This is true. I'm sorry. So now you can check that this is gauge invariant.
Analysis with filler brains.
With fewer brains, of course, to put the standard model.
Filler brains. Those that sit on identical
planes.
There you typically get, you know, there are FP groups there, but then you get the.
Okay,
I think
you can discuss it in.
Yeah, but maybe you should try that.
Yes, actually, here there is four stack, actually, which I forgot. Okay, there is a four stack here. Okay, the point is not, I mean, I don't have a model which is completely, give completely this. However, you can check, you take this kind of local model, you satisfy all anomaly conditions correctly, even if the model is not, again, it's not really a global one. If you find a global model, again, the anomaly cancellation works, of course, perfectly. However, you don't have this condition here. You have more flavors. So you can check this gauge invariant, actually. You can check this gauge invariant, and you can also check in this case, that this model, if the other brains play no role, which I don't know if play no role, you can check that this model has the same feature as the one I talked at the beginning. In other words, it seems to break supersymmetry. But I agree that's a local model. Okay. So I don't have a global example, which has number of flavors, length, the number of colors, and work exactly the way I said beginning. Okay, this is this part here. Now for flavor effects, I don't think I have time, and actually I don't have neither something very, I think, non-trivial for people to say, just to tell you that, of course, if these C1s are universal, and they have give big contributions to the masses by B terms, then you solve the flavor problem. The phi field couples in a way which does not destroy the flavor structure. Okay, I cannot discuss this because we don't have time, but if the charges are universal, then the phi field will couple in a universal way as well. If and that goes back to this Frog and Nielsen kind of structure, actually. Okay, the loophole in what I'm saying is the following. The loophole is that these Yukawa couplings, what I was saying is that if you have a superpotential, what I'm saying is not completely correct because, okay, if you have a superpotential for quarks, let's say, which contains this field to appropriate power, like in this Frog and Nielsen mechanism, let me put Q the charges of these fields. What I'm saying is that if the charges are universal, even if this gets the F term, you get a universal contribution to the A terms in this particular case. The loophole is that you have Hirokawa coupling, which depends on moduli. So if these are non-trivial, and moreover, if they have a charge under D1, then this charge will be different, and then the whole story changes. And it would be probably interesting to see an explicit example in which you have charges which are not universal. The charges are not universal, but still, the charges which are universal, therefore you solve the flavor problem. However, this will fix the Yukawa couplings itself. But I have nothing particularly intelligent to say about it. Thank you.
Is there a way in one of the examples to get split supersymmetry in this case, or one of them?
Yes. Take one of these examples. In order to get the split supersymmetry, what you need to do is the following. Instead of putting this kind of fluxes, which preserve supersymmetry, have equal volume at some point, put anti-plane-like charges, which break completely supersymmetry. For example, put a flux which is like that. You induce a failure closed term which is like that. There is no way you can cancel it, actually. No way. And then you can generate split supersymmetry. But however, it's broken from the start, really. You start from a model which has fluxes which break from the start supersymmetry. So, but you can
break. How do you mean the Gugino is small?
I'm sorry?
In the split supersymmetry, the Gugino's are light, right?
Well, you know, if the D terms are very, very large here, the D terms don't really. D terms give very large mass to scalars, but not to fermions, not to Gauginos. So in principle, it could work. The only the thing you should worry is the Higgs sector, actually.
Yeah.
You need the D mu, which is relatively large, and that we have to fix. But for Gauginos, it's easy. Yes.
The statement that can't integrate out this field.
Yes.
Because you do have a fucking see the margin, and you know, below, what does the theory look like?
No, I can integrate them out.
Okay.
But I'm generating soft terms, which I have to keep. I can integrate out the field phi.
Yeah, but then there shouldn't be soft terms, because you should have, you know, a nice supersymmetric Lagrangian.
The field, the auxiliary field of this field breaks supersymmetry.
Yeah, but I mean, I think if this theory coupled to supergravity or something, there's a gravity mode that's like, I thought there's a theorem that says that the soft terms have to show up as half components of the field.
Yes. That's true here.
Phi is in the Lagrangian.
No.
So phi is a massive field. And
so what I know how to do the analysis by keeping the field phi, and then I know that I generate the F terms and soft terms. How it works if we integrate it out,
okay.
But please.
I actually learned the answer to this question from Michael's paper, so he has the answer.
Okay.
The way it works is you integrate out the massive field, you induce a universal coordinate correction to the potential.
Mm-hmm.
So you evaluate that in the presence of any non-trivial F terms that result in the scenario, it precisely reproduces the decom contribution to any soft terms. So
there's a completely self-consistent
picture with
but where is the remind me in that paper the term over the what serves, let me put it this way, what is the is it Goldstino the trace of M or something? Who's the
Goldstino is a combination here. It could be a D break and would be this the Gugino of the C1. In this example which I showed you, it's not really a pure debreaking. Actually, there is not pure debreaking. This is from the actually coming back to the uplifting. It's not pure debreaking, of course. It's a mixture. That's why it works.
No, it is actually. I don't remember what we said in that paper. Yeah. Okay.